Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw.
What about my
book? Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.
What about my book?
Samira, go away. At iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod.
What about my book then?
And in this episode, I'm joined by Samira Ahmed. Hello.
Hello. Hello. That was you'd have to know the album, but your listeners all know exactly what that is referenced to.
So, first question, okay. What about your book then?
I know, I'm very excited.
So am I. Tell me more. I've read it, it's very good.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I kind of wanted to know what you thought of it, because I set out to write a book which captured not just the joy of watching the film, but look in some detail at what the Beatles became as a result of it and the impact of the film on pop music, on cinema, and in a way what it revealed about how Britain was changing. So I've got a whole chapter on the women in the film, and I've got a whole chapter on the TV industry, because I think this collision of high and low culture that the Beatles were at the heart of was just a great story. So, yeah, my bit of social history. And I've got to credit you, Chris, because, you know, coming on your podcast back in, was it 2019?
Oh, gosh.
2018?
Yeah.
was sort of the spark, because, I realised I had all these thoughts, had me thinks, and I started to express them. And now I've come back to express them on Eggpod Express. So they've all gone to the book as well. So, yeah, I'm really pleased. And it's got loads of photographs from the film, including production shots. You can see how they shot certain things, like the jumping around in the field and stuff.
Yeah.
They weren't actually flying through the air.
The research must have been so much fun.
It was so much fun. And there's a lot on the record, but there's a lot which you can put together. I found three young women who'd been in the audience, or two had been in the concert, sort of screaming, and one had been in the opera scene with Wilfred Bramble when he comes up through the trapdoor. And that was quite interesting, just the story of how, short notice, they recruited people, you know, the day before the shoot, people going around finding, you know, music students to get to do this stuff. And you know, what the sort of interactions with the Beatles in the canteen. And, you know, there's a lot more that hasn't been told. You'd think you know everything there is to know, but there's always more if you know. And, of course, David Janssen, the boy in the Riverside scene, was such a generous interviewee and shared so much about that shoot and the way that adults behaved around the Beatles, which in itself is quite interesting.
Yeah, he looks amazing, doesn't he?
Well, I met him, of course, at Eggpod we did to mark the 60th anniversary of the film, and he's recognisably that young man, that youthful energy in him. So he'll be coming to the book launch, and he'll be at that film screening, which incidentally is, I don't know when this is, if it will have happened by the time this goes out, but my God, that's selling fast. Like, there's so much love for this film, I think.
Well, and you. I mean, this book is great. Yeah. Not just another Beatles book. This is one of the best Beatles books. It really is. But you're talking about the social culture at the time, challenging the establishment.
It's
the whole of the 60s rather than just another Beatles book.
And what's really interesting looking at, you know, this issue of NME that we're going to talk about is you realise how much of an outlier that film was, like the Beatles. You know, it was defying the really quite often quite frustratingly simple and dumb rules that there were around things and some of the very formulaic way that music and music acts were presented. And they just tore up those rules and they just did things their own way and absolutely were trailblazers. I mean, that film and what they do in it, thanks to Richard Lester, of course, and the script and the cinematographer and the editing and everything, it really holds its own to this day. People have tried to copy it, but very rarely has anyone come close.
Well, I don't think anyone has, have they? I can't think of any other films that come close.
Well, I think The Privilege, which they talk about in the book, is kind of the nightmare. To use a Stranger Things analogy, it's the upside down of a hard day's night.
Well, that sort of foreshadows Stardust.
Well, I know, it's more than that, because it's about the idea of the same kind of hysteria, but being controlled by the establishment rather than defying the establishment. Mm. And a pop star being destroyed by his success. There's all this stuff about politicians trying to manipulate pop music and pop stars. It's quite a politically dystopian thing, which, I mean, Peter Watkins, the director, was that kind of person.
Yeah. So in this episode, we're looking at an issue of New Musical Express, published on the 10th of July, 1964. And the Accordion Times Musical Express was a hugely popular publication in the 1930s and 40s. But by 1952, it had its day and the plug was about to be pulled until a last-minute reprieve by music promoter Morris Kinn saved the day. And he bought the paper for £1,000 and on the 7th of March 1952 was relaunched under its new name, New Musical Express. And this explains why the first edition isn't listed at number one, but it's number 169, brackets, new series. And it's a heartbreaking moment for diehard accordionists because it dropped all mention of the pump-powered Parping pianos and instead focused on the interviews with artists alongside news, reviews and gossip. And taking its lead from the US Billboard just 8 months after its launch, The Enemy published the first ever UK singles chart, compiled by the paper itself, based on regional sales. And this appeared on the 14th of November of that year. First number one, by the way, was Al Martino's Here in My Heart. And by the 1960s, Enemy had been officially registered at the GPO as a, quote, newspaper. And the edition we're looking at today was published on the 10th of July 1964, edited by Canadian Andy Gray. Not that one. Did you read The Enemy as a kid?
I didn't read it as a kid. I read it in my 20s when Britpop was very big and, you know, yeah. It was quite exciting and, I mean, you had that sense that the whole musical world was sort of in Camden, which is quite funny. Yeah, that inky feeling. I used to read The Enemy and The Melody Maker at that time. I used to get them both. I really enjoyed them. Looking at this, it's interesting. You know, there's still a sheet music chart. It's still a kind of last connection to the old accordion music thing. And they've got vintage charts to compare. They've got 5 years ago and 10 years ago. So already the sense of looking back at pop music, even just in 64, when it's barely 10 years old,
yeah.
Properly.
Yeah.
Because I always think of rock and roll starting properly in 1955. That's what the documentaries tell you. So the idea of looking at pop charts from 1954 in 1964 is quite interesting. But then you also realise how fabulous the music was in the 50s.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I was feeling nostalgic with the 50s, reading this from the 60s, which is quite interesting.
Now, you've all made a fortune. Have you got any future ambition in mind? No, I don't want to borrow any, John. Have you got any future in mind now? Any other ambitions?
I don't know. I'd like to make more films, I think. We'd all like to do that, because it's good fun, you know. It's hard work, but you can have a good laugh in films.
What about you, Ringo?
Same, I enjoy films.
You do?
Well, I think, you know, all of us want to do sort of a good film, you know, one that we all think's good, and make more good records.
Don't you think this one's any good,
well,
then?
Well, it's okay, you know what I mean. But make good records,
not
I think.
Not as good as James Bond, though, is it?
Oh, not as good as James Bond.
Yes, you fancy yourselves as actors, then, do you?
No, definitely not.
You?
But, I mean, we enjoyed making the last film, and especially with the director. The director was great, you see, and it made it much easier for us. None of us rate ourselves as actors, but, you know, it's a good laugh and we enjoy doing it. So we'd like to make a couple more.
Just as a bit more context, what else was happening when this issue was published on the 10th of July, 64?
Well, most famously, of course, the Hard Day's Night, the film, had just opened in the West End and was about to have its Northern premiere, I think, and had already sold, I mean, the album had sold a million copies, I think, on pre-order in the US.
Yeah.
I mean, it was phenomenal. So that's the big change, is that the Beatles are definitely the biggest thing in the world. And then the whole Merseybeat sound has taken over. I mean, Jerry and the Pacemakers, people like that are doing very well in the US charts. So you have that sense of that the tipping point has happened and we're now in the middle of this moment, I think it's fair to say. The House of the Rising Sun by the Animals is number one and they've just broken through now.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the UK.
So yeah, as you say, yeah, on this very day of publication, they'd released Hard Day's Night album and they also flew to Liverpool for the Northern premiere of the movie at the Odeon Cinema. And 4 days earlier, it'd been obviously the London premiere at the Pavilion, attended by Princess Margaret. Interestingly, the previous week, Cliff Richard's Wonderful Life had been premiered at the Empire Theatre, Leicester Square, but he only got Princess Alexandra. He didn't get Princess Margaret. Oh. It's a shame.
Well, that's one of the things I look at in the book is, you know, it is the tipping point for within Britain, certainly, that Cliff is eclipsed by the Beatles. I mean, Wonderful Life wasn't a great film at all. Unfortunately, unlike Summer Holiday, which was, but it's just, you know, it's like you're watching the ascendancy of the Beatles and Cliff Richard's kind of just tipping down in the other direction and he doesn't even know it. I mean, I was looking at the singles charts in this issue and the album, I think, is doing very well. and you know, and there's a couple of Shadows albums as well in the top 10, and with the Beatles is still in the top 10. But you know, the Hard Day's Night, the album hasn't yet quite been released, I think, in time to make this chart.
No, it was on this. But that's, yeah, on this very day.
On this day.
So, what was on telly today? Watch with Mother with the Wooden Tops.
I love the Wooden Tops, even though they used to repeat them well into the early 70s, I think. I was terrified of them.
But Audrey Atterby and Molly Gibson pulling the strings, Gladys Winifred singing the songs, Peter Hawkins speaking the voices. And for golf fans and absolutely no one else, there was the Open Championship from St Andrews. Spoiler alert, Jack Nicklaus lost to Tony Lima. That was basically on all day today. At 5:10, it's more adventures with Deputy Dawg. In today's episode, DD finds that he has something to learn in order to keep up with his pals Musky and Vince. And at 9:10, it's The Graham Stark Show. And tonight's big variety show is Carnival, with entertaining sets by Danny Williams, the Clark Brothers, and the terrifyingly named troupe, the Stretch Cox Limbo Group.
It's terrifying. Well, Graham Stark, of course, who went on to be in a lot of Blake Edwards films, I think the Pink Panther films, he collaborated a lot with Richard Lester and had been in a show called Fred and Son of Fred with all those Spike Milligan scripted adventures. So there's a little link there to the Beatles.
Oh, there's links everywhere in this.
Wishing and hoping and thinking and praying, planning and dreaming, each night of her charms. It won't get you into her arms. So if you're looking to find love, you can share. All you gotta do is hold her and kiss her and love her and show her that you care.
So let's go in.
Well, can we stop by talking about the cover? Because I mean, what was shocking was I looked at this cover and my heart sank. I thought, oh, bloody hell. And I'll tell you why, because the big image on the front is the Mersey Beats looking like they're trying to be the Beatles in about late 1962 with their leather waistcoats. And they actually look like they're wearing mop top wigs. And you realise just how entrenched the desperation was for all these bands trying to cash in on the same thing. And they're all trapped in the past already.
Yeah. I'd say it's more the record labels. I mean, this is Fontana, isn't it? Fontana, and especially Decca, because Decca had obviously lost out when they didn't get the Beatles, and they're just signing all and sundry.
I mean, the Merseys obviously went on to, when they rebranded as the Merseys, that song Sorrow, which David Bowie famously covered on Pin-Ups, is a magnificent song. I mean, there are some cracking songs, so I'm not knocking, you know, the music in a sense. It's just so sobering to remember how, you know, like that scene in the film of A Hard Day's Night when they're in the, you know, George wanders into the advertising agency and everyone's just trying to market and monetize and make as much as they can off youth culture by throwing clones of it. It's like AI has generated all these different versions of the Beatles, none of which have a fraction of their charisma or originality.
No. Poor Mersey Beats.
By beechnut, by gum, by beechnut, by gum, the flavor starts lively,
the flavor stays lively,
by beechnut, by gum.
More flavor to chew, more flavors to choose, like regular spearmint, or the newest, coolest spearmint, new beechnut frosty mint gum. There's frosty mint flavor in it, there's more frosty mint flavor on it, in each minty green swirl. For flavor that starts lively, stays lively, buy beechnut, buy gum,
buy gum.
So let's turn to page 2, and this gives us a real idea of the way the youth were being sold to. My favourite thing on the left, it's Anglo Beet Mint Chewing Gum.
Beet, says, beet, beet. There's some, it says in the advert, as if, I don't know, was the beet supposed to be like cartoon shouts? It's just, I mean, in a way you think, you know, Richard Lester used Patty Boyd as the Smith's Crisp Girl. And she posed like that in photographs and press and was also in TV adverts. So in a sense, the photographic image is usually the most sort of simplistic. But you've just got these kind of people vaguely twisting behind. It's just wretched, really. Oh, and actually the cover of the packaging looks like it's got a guitar playing mop-toppy person and someone on, is that a saxophone or a trumpet on the other side?
I can't see. It's blowing something, but they're very Beatly.
Yeah. I'm interested that Anglo-American chewing gum seems to be based in Halifax in Yorkshire. Who knew?
It is. Yeah. Well, Macintosh created it, and they were always tuned into the kids' market, hence the Anglo Beat Mints. But they also produced a whole host of chewing gum and bubble gum cards.
Mm.
And this hopefully will interest you. 1967, they released two 66 card sets, Space and Captain Scarlet. And the Captain Scarlet cards featured action series or TV photos on one side, with pieces of a poster illustrated by Ron Ebbleton on the reverse. And you basically made a jigsaw from these.
Do you know, it does make me feel, you know, whenever you think, oh God, it's terrible the times we live in and the internet is destroying so much, you think, yeah, but at least we don't have to, like, we're not so desperate for imagery of our famous, our favourite pop stars and shows that we have to buy bits of card and stick them together.
But they also later did, in 68, they did a Joe 91 and a Yellow Submarine card set.
Okay.
Which you pay a bloody fortune for now if you get those. Yeah. They're super expensive.
I'm quite interested in the big holiday attraction advert on the right of this page, which is on stage at the Gaumont Weymouth. And it's exactly the kind of, you know, kind of multiple act lineup show that the Beatles used to be part of when they started out. And I just miss the days when, you know, there's a form that you could cut out, a printed form you could cut out and fill in and tell them how many tickets you want in the stalls and circles and give them an alternative date and post it off and they'll send you your tickets.
And you'd have to go down to the post office, get a postal order. It was a big old rigmarole.
Yeah, but it's probably less stress in a certain way than sitting waiting millionth person in the queue to get tickets for Taylor Swift. I mean, I just find myself constantly checking, you know, the limits of the technology then against the supposed possibilities of technology today and how when it comes to music and music consumption and gigs, it's not actually much fun and it's not that much easier getting things at it. And then, you know, there was one price, there was no touts, were unlikely to be many.
It says a lot of, at the time, all these sort of package tours. I mean, the Gaumont was a massive cinema theatre venue and it's used for touring pop shows and loads of these acts and seaside summer residences, and they were really common at this time, because obviously you had the huge holidaymaker audience. So resort towns, a lot of this stuff appeared. But it's also on a bigger story, I guess, from 66, 67 onwards, when albums became, as we'll find out throughout this, singles are the main thing. But once people started investing in albums, bands had more material that people would know to record. So you tend to have a band supported by another band.
Yeah, so that's the tipping point, is it, for that?
I think
that's
so. Yeah. But we've also got two 70s and 80s art. Shane Fenton and the Fentones is playing.
That's, of all the lame names, it's one of the lamest, don't you think?
Well, he was Alvin Stardust.
Of course he was.
And then Sid and Eddie, two bright young men, Canadians, little and large.
Oh, yeah, they are. Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
That is very sweet. Well spotted.
Bless them. Bright young men back in those days.
Whatever that meant.
And we'll have that thing off as well, thank you. But an elementary knowledge of the Railway Act would tell you that I'm perfectly within my rights.
Yeah, but we want to hear it. There's more of us than you. We're a community, a charity vote, up the workers and all that stuff.
Then I suggest you take that damn thing into the corridor, or some other part of the train, where you obviously belong.
Give us a kiss.
Look, mister, we pay for our seats too, you know.
I travel on this train regularly, twice a week.
Knock it off, Paul. You can't win with his sword. After all, it's his train, isn't it, mister?
And don't take that tone with me, young man. I fought the war for your sword.
I bet you saw you won.
I shall call the guard.
Ah, but what? They don't take kindly to insults, you know. Come on, let's go and have some coffee and leave the kennel to Lassie.
The fonts, I've got to say, it's a piece of design. The fonts in this
issue
are terrible. So you go on to the next page, page three, and it's a big spread on the Beatles film, A Hard Day's Night, which the writer's obviously gone and seen at the premiere or caught in the last couple of days and written actually a really inaccurate précis of the film where he's got things in the wrong order and got facts wrong about who does what. But the headline, which is Beatles Great Comics, it's like, what's that font you use in Westerns that looks like it's made out of wood?
It is.
It's like that. It's like wagon.
Yeah.
Wagon wheel font.
A bit Letraceti.
Yeah.
But yeah, he says, the Beatles are a hit all over again as comedians. Scream ages have never allowed them to be heard conversationally before.
Well, that's probably quite true. I mean, that was one of the things about the film. You actually heard them talking. I mean, assuming that people weren't screaming in the audience throughout the film, you actually got to be in a room with them, in a sense, and see them up close. And actually, I always think the biggest achievement of that film is hearing a concert, hearing them perform. which you just couldn't do in reality.
I mean, the only other way would be the BBC radio shows, where you'd hear them. But anybody watching TV or watching films, they never did interviews, did they? They never did, as we see in Hard Day's Night, it'd just be the odd, maybe Morecambe and Wise or something like that, little skits.
Yeah, skits and things, I suppose. It's later on in the 60s they start appearing, talking about transcendental meditation.
Oh, gosh, yeah, yeah. But let's basically talk about your book some more. I love your bit about the train scene, the authority figures. You know, rather than shouting at them, the Beatles laugh at them, which is far more subversive. There's so much depth to this.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a bit about sort of the sort of structure of it. I mean, I start with an introduction which sets the scene a bit, which is what's going on in Britain in 1964 and why I think the film had the impact it did, which is that, you know, deference is breaking down and adults are discovering the Beatles through things like television. So television is a really big part of the Beatles' story. I think that's what's instrumental in how they take over the world. It's not that the music isn't brilliant, but it's people watching them on the Ed Sullivan Show, then being beamed into living rooms, and adults seeing their children getting into it themselves. And so that's sort of the scene setting. And then, so with the book, I started off with the idea of a DVD-style commentary where, you know, we'll go through the film scene by scene and watch it together. And in that, some of what I go through is sort of little insights into how they pulled stuff off or unexpected things about how things were filmed or things that we didn't know, like John's real dad turning up at the theatre where they were shooting A Hard Day's Night and saying, "I'm John's dad, I want to be let in." You know, just like Paul's fictional grandfather saying, "Oh, I'm Paul's grandfather, let me in." And that actually was happening around the same time. It was kind of weird. And then so I had a second chapter on the production, like how the film got commissioned and made and the practicalities of it. And then I go into, well, the Beatles and TV, the film and television, which is Richard Lester's story of becoming a film director, is that he was a great TV director. So a lot of the power of the film is not just that it's set in the world of TV, which he knows very well, but it's shot like television with multiple cameras for the concert scene. So it's very much composed in the edit. And then the chapter that I really wanted to write, and I wrote it very early on in the process, was a chapter just about the women in the book. Sorry, the women in the film and all the different types, starting with the schoolgirls to the secretary in the office, Millie, the Anna Quayle character, the makeup artists, the production assistant in the gallery to Victor Spinetti, who could be a Verity Lambert style director herself, really. And, you know, you realise this is a world of women entering the workplace in a completely different way. And I found that quite interesting. And then I think I had a chapter about the reception of the film and, you know, looking a lot at the press cuttings and things like that. And finally, the sort of legacy of the film, how it's changed pop music, but also changed the Beatles and what they all went on to do in terms of film, with, you know, George famously becoming a very successful film producer of some of the most. And, you know, I really think the most interesting thing about the films that George went on to make is that they're like the anti-establishment film. So, you know, think about the 80s and there's films like all the Merchant Ivory stuff that won all the awards, like Howard's End. But actually, what are the films that, I mean, I'm not saying Howard's End's not a great film, but what are the films that people really love still and talk about? They are The Life of Brian. They are With Nail and I. Mona Lisa, it's a dark film, but it's bloody magnificent. Mm. And he made some of the most important British landmark films of the 1980s, but won very few awards. But they are the films that we recognise as masterpieces, I think.
Oh, 100%. And you also made a really good point about the Profumo affair.
Yeah, which, for those who don't know, was this, you know, really big scandal. I mean, forget Peter Mandelson in a different way. This was, you know, I mean, a man who'd been having an affair with a very young woman who was also sleeping with a Russian attaché and had lied about it in the House of Commons, which in those days lying was considered absolutely unforgivable. And he was caught out lying and he had to resign and spent the rest of his life. He only died a few years ago, actually, in working for charity. But It shocked people that the idea of these, you know, these posh, and he was, you know, he's a very privileged man, you know, these posh rich people hanging out at Clifton House, and, you know, there was all these issues about drug taking and these, and I mean, what people at the time didn't appreciate was this. Actually, there was a big sexual exploitation element of it. These very, very young women, you know, teenage girls essentially, being so-called good time girls, who were basically being groomed and used by powerful men. So Christine Keeler, famously, and Mandy Rice Davis, who was her friend. So that whole scandal had broken in 63. And so I think it did change the way that most ordinary people felt about those who they used to think ran things because they should run things. And, you know, I looked at a lot of interviews the Beatles were doing around this time when they're coming back from America and they're interviewed at airports. And the people talk to them about what's going on in politics. And, you know, Ted Heath, who was then in government, I think as some kind of junior minister or something, had made some comment about he didn't really understand the way they talked, and he didn't really couldn't appreciate it as the Queen's English. It didn't seem to be like the Queen's English, the way that they spoke. And, you know, John says, well, we won't be voting for Ted, you know, yes. And looks straight at the camera. And I mean, it's months before the general election. But I suspect that all played a part in people thinking, you know what, these people are finished. This party that was in power at the time, the Conservative Party, led by Harold Macmillan, was, you know, and linked to the Profumo scandal because he was a Tory minister, that they represented something that Britain wanted to shake off. And, you know, absolutely, Harold Wilson rides the wave and jumps on the bandwagon, sorry to mix my metaphors, by hanging out with the Beatles at that Variety Club Award in the middle of shooting Hard Day's Night, give them their Personalities of the Year prize, you know. The Beatles are gold. I mean, you know, everyone wants to touch them.
It's no surprise that John often appeared on Pete and Dud's show, because Peter Cook was doing the same thing with the establishment, wasn't he, really?
That's right. Well, the Establishment Club, of course, which had been set up, I think, in 63, which, you know, and it had people like Eleanor Bron, of course, was one of the actors, comedians, used to do comedy at the Establishment Club. So, you know, and Richard Lester himself, you know, says that he bonded with them very much with this sense of, you know, especially after the Suez crisis of 1956, I think it was, you know, this horror that these, you know, again, that's another crisis even before the Prino affair, that made people feel, I don't trust these people in charge, you know, and a sense of trusting your own instincts, and young people in particular, who no longer had conscription, of course.
Yes.
I mean, that's such a big part of their story, isn't it? Of being able to not be crushed by conformity.
Oh, that's a huge part. I mean, we can link that to an advert at the bottom of this.
Oh, yeah.
The Baron Knights with Duke de Monde. Call up the groups.
There's a little town in Cyprus that's hanging out the streamers to welcome the arrival of Freddy and the Dreamers. Corporal in the cavalry, please don't pick on me. I am only 5'3". Now I don't like the army life, the Air Force don't like me. Now I can't join the Navy, 'cause I get sick at sea.
This is basically a template for their 70s career. And it's all about songs like the Beatles, Searchers, Stones, all about being called up for, you know, join the forces.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of parody of conscription.
Yeah.
And yes, and it tells new words too. So it sort of has to explain that, you know, they're doing kind of parody versions of great stuff. But, you know, the adverts that really jump out at me throughout this issue, Chris, are like some of the amazing American acts coming through, and African-American acts. Like Ray Charles and his orchestra is playing the Odeon Hammersmith, the Astoria, Finsbury Park and the New Victoria. And also, I couldn't help looking at the adverts for tapes.
Yes.
There's a big advert on the same page for Philips reel-to-reel tapes. And I keep thinking about John Bloomfield recording, you know, the Beatles at Stowe School on actually not bad quality, considering how far away his microphone was. That actually this interesting technology is really at use at home.
We tell you, it's going to be all right, all right, all right. As an explosion of musical fun hits the screen, it's Jerry and the Pacemakers, and they aren't just all right. They're terrific in their first full-length motion picture.
I was going to skip onto the next page just because there's a connection in the next review. Having reviewed the Beatles film and said they're all great comedians in a, you know, very sort of trite, literal way, you know, it sort of just tells you what happens in the film and tells you that they're funny. The next page is On Location with Jerry and the Pacemakers during the shooting of Ferry Across the Mersey, which of course was the film that came out, I think, only a few months after A Hard Day's Night. It's got the same cinematographer, Gilbert Taylor, and the locations of this film are great, but it's an awful film. And I had the whole section of my book about this film, which it's the worst sort of cash-in. And what's remarkable is, of course, it is Brian Epstein. He's produced the film again, and it's full of his acts that he's trying to promote. And I was just struck by the lack of distinction in so many of them. I mean, I do think the Jerry and the Pacemakers made some great songs, but the whole plot of this film is so crass. And I will say it, much as I love Cilla Black, and I thought she was great on Blind Date, I hated her voice and I hated her singing. She was like a bloody foghorn. It was like being bashed over the head every time she sang. And I never understood why she was rated as a great singer. She couldn't interpret music. Sorry, I'll say that and now people can hate me, but...
She did, there's a recording of her with Paul in 68 doing Step Inside Love. And she says during the recording session, shall I use my soft voice or loud voice? And when she uses her soft voice, it's really not, I really like it.
Really?
But as soon as it That's gets into that loud voice, I think Limmy, the comedian, mentioned that it sounds like there's a particular setting on a keyboard that is exactly the same frequency as Scylla when she goes loud.
Reaching out, holding hands.
Reaching out, holding hands.
Hands.
We live in memory. As we smile.
In the nicest, you know, like that. It's not, she's not just going, na, 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 or even going, na, 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 na. It's, and it's got a biting, ow, ow. Like, yum, yum, yum. It's like, she sounds like a, actually sounds like a 303. It sounds like a 303. What's a song that kind of sounds quite like that? It's surprising that it's kind of...
It's funny, isn't it, to know that she had a different... settings, just was never encouraged to use it, because I think I spoke to John Raine about the film Alfie, and if you remember, yeah. Cillian Black had the single that was a huge hit, but the actual version sung on the end of the soundtrack of the film and the closing titles are sung by Cher, and the Cher version I could listen to again and again. It's beautiful, it's quizzical, it's moving and very knowing, and it's got very shimmering, beautiful arrangement. And the Cillian Black version is, say, like being like a foghorn. I mean, they couldn't, it's like they're two different songs to me. So that's just by the by. But yes, there is a really fun section of my book on some of the terrible racist and creepy things, like Jimmy Savile features in this film.
Oh.
And there's a whole kind of comedy joke thing, allegedly, about Chinese people. It's just, it's so awful. I watched it so that you don't have to, is what I'm saying. But what's interesting is the same cinematographer, so the locations, including, you know, I think, I don't think they shot in the Cavern Club, but it feels like they shot and they captured in this film, in Very Cross the Mersey, a lot of Liverpool that disappeared not long after.
Mm.
And for that reason, it's got a kind of historical value. But I'd watch it with the sound off, personally, if I had the choice. Oh, and Margaret Nolan's in it. You know, the woman in the nightclub scene who's at the casino table with Granddad. And she was, of course, famously the blonde figure who's in the opening credit sequence to Goldfinger, the opening credits projected onto her body. She plays a life model in this, in Ferry Across the Mersey. So there's unexpected little connections. And there's connections like who wrote the film. Wasn't it Tony Warren of Coronation Street, who was one of the people Richard Lester had wanted to write the screenplay for A Hard Day's Night? I mean, there was a lot of interesting writers around at the time, like, you know, is it Johnny Spate who went on to write or suggest the idea for Privilege? So I'm interested that all of them in different ways have done interesting work, but they also, I mean, as I say, Ferry Across the Mersey, it's just, maybe it's a blessing. Maybe this is the script that Tony Warren would have turned in for the Beatles.
Mm.
I mean, they wouldn't have made it, but...
Interesting choice, because Tony Warren... You look at some of those old Coronation Street clips and it is pure art, the way he's captured language.
Yeah, no,
I think he would have done a fine job.
Yeah, I don't know why this film is so awful.
Oh, mother, tell your children not to do what I have done. Spend your lives in sin. In the house of the rising sun.
Page 5, we have the animals get wrapped up and go on and on.
Right, now this was the only interesting article that I really enjoyed in this issue. And it says, Richard Green recalls their London debut. And it's basically, he goes out in London with them and they've obviously had this huge hit. They've moved to London. And it's sort of a bit like the early days of the Beatles when they all lived in, you know, a flat in Mayfair. And if you went to interview them, they were all sort of excited. And he goes with Eric Burdon into Cambridge Circus near the edge of Soho to look for imported American records. And, you know, the enthusiasm that comes across from Eric Burdon for real rhythm and blues, and also this expression of kind of shock and surprise that, you know, I find it baffling that Americans are buying our music, you know, as in white British R&B acts, when they have all this amazing music themselves, and I want to hear the real thing. And that sincerity, which has always come across with Eric Burdon and the Animals, I think, that's absolutely captured in this article. You know, the sincerity and the enthusiasm, I absolutely loved it.
Reading through the article, there's a quote, "We've not had any time to hold a party or anything to celebrate," said Eric Burdon in his agent's office. "Cars? I'm not getting one. I don't know about the rest. I'm going to get a motorbike so that I can get through the London traffic quicker." The clock ticked its way past 5 and the boys began making plans for a ballroom date later. Getting back to their respective London homes, changing, having another interview, eating and then finding their way to the dance hall had to be accomplished in the space of less than 3 hours. And we all know about the Beatles' hectic schedule, but all of them were doing the same thing.
Yeah. That's what's really lovely. That's when you capture a sense of the moment in time when all these exciting young acts are finding success. And London is this really amazing city to be in. And, you know, people are just travelling around it in a very relaxed way. And I suppose the screaming, I mean, I know the Animals would have had some fandom following them, but at this stage probably hasn't quite happened for them. They're able to still pass around the city with relative ease and enjoy it.
If I've ever exploited anybody, it's for their own benefit. It's because they want to be exploited. I never exploit anybody who doesn't want to be exploited.
I mean, it mentions their manager, Giorgio Gomelski, and he was like a pivotal figure in the 60s British blues scene. And he played a key role in the early career of the Animals as a promoter and a producer. So he helped transition them from the Alan Price rhythm and blues combo into the London music scene. And he was basically short-lived because you can see the hectic schedule he's making them do. And he was quite a tough manager. And arguably, they'd get an even tougher manager next with Don Arden. And I love the story, Ian McLagan from The Small Faces. He was saying they'd had a call from Don Arden who wanted to sign them up. So they went along for a meeting just as the Animals were all coming out. And they basically said, "Don't go near him with a barge pole." But they were like young kids and they said, "Oh, no, no, it'll be fine, it'll be fine." And it wasn't, sadly.
Well, the other sad thing is, of course, the number one hit they've just had that is recorded in this issue is "Has the Rising Sun." And that was to cause them so much torment because, you know, they didn't realise at the time that all the royalties, the ownership and the credit for the arrangement was going to go to Alan Price, who'd put his name on it. And very, very sad. Do you want to reach out to them and say, "No, wait, stop."
Welcome to another session of Jukebox Jury.
We also have a letters section here from you to us.
I like these letters, so they're really interesting. And a lot of them are sort of very critical of the Rolling Stones' performance on Jukebox Jury. Yeah. Do you know what happened? Because most Jukebox Juries have been wiped, haven't they? We have never survived these episodes that are much talked about. They behaved in a... were they rude or...
Yeah, well, it was on the 4th of July episode, and as you say, there's no footage, but we do have, you know, managed to glean together some stuff. The Stones appeared as panellists, and they created a scandal with their, quote, gum-chewing behaviour and blunt critiques.
Maybe they chewed some of that beet gum that was advertised earlier in the issue.
They dismissed several records and called Elvis Presley dated.
Yeah, so the people in this letters column are not taking that, and I'm really glad.
Yeah, there's a couple here, aren't there?
There's a great one, I don't know if this is true, it's like, is it John Percy from Berkshire saying, "So intense is this man's concentration that He often dropped his guitar pick in the middle of a take, and rather than stop, he went on playing with his bare thumb until his hand was covered in blood. Who else but the king of entertainment would do this? I've never heard this story about Elvis Presley before, but I love the mythology.
Yeah. Eileen Quinn goes, how the Rolling Stones had the nerve to appear on last week's Jukebox Jury, I'll never know. I've always looked on JBG as being a sensible discussion of records by normal, intelligent people. Why the sudden change? But as well as these letters, they were also criticised in the Daily Sketch, who called them ill-mannered and illogical. Others defended them as being honest and frank. So, yeah, all we do know is the band verdicts on this week's singles on Jukebox Jury. Hits, they said, were Dusty Springfield's I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, Freddie and the Dreamers' Just for You, and The Searchers' Someday We're Going to Leave Again. Misses were Tobacco Road by Nashville Teens. That surprised me. Ray Charles, My Baby Don't Dig Me. That surprised me even more. Christine Holmes, Play Me a Sad Song. And the Everly Brothers, Ferris Wheel.
Oh, I love Ferris Wheel. That's a great song.
You better write to the enemy.
It's sinister. I think I will write now. I'm going to send my letter back in time.
Once upon a time, I almost lost my mind. I was lonely. So lonely. Once upon a time, hoping every day things would go my way. Then you came into my life. Now everything is fine.
Page six, we have singles reviewed by Derek Johnson. There's a lot in here.
Again, it's striking how the random mix of fonts and headlines. But at the centre, there's a lovely double picture of Marvin Gaye and Mary Wells. And it's a sort of singling out that particular song as a kind of great pick.
Yeah, that was Once Upon a Time, because they don't actually mention it in the article.
It's also interesting what a sort of bizarre mix of things there is. I mean, there's sort of Johnny Mathis, Peter Paul and Mary. But there's also Chubby Checker and the Ronettes and Freddie and the Dreamers and Four Seasons. You have a real mix of American and UK acts. I was really struck by at the bottom, there's an advert for Listen to Alan Dell's Showcase on Radio Luxembourg, which was such an important radio station at a time when you still didn't have anything like regular, legal pop music. You know, it was Pirates have just about started, hadn't they? In March 64, I think Radio Caroline began broadcasting. So all that world is still quite new. So Radio Luxembourg is still quite an important outlet for rock music. Yeah. Oh, and I've got to point out the best-selling LPs in Britain on the right of this page. So Rolling Stones, Rolling Stones number one. Kissing Cousins by Elvis Presley is number two. Cliff Richard, The Wonderful Life album is number three. And then there's also The Shadows, lower down. And West Side Story is in there at number nine. And you suddenly have this sense of, gosh, these landmarks of culture like West Side Story, the musical, which is going to change so much. And then just above that is With the Beatles.
Yeah, still there.
Which, you know, presumably the following week, you would have seen something very different with Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, that would be released, wouldn't it? So, yeah, and also at number 10, the latest and greatest Chuck Berry. Because you think at the time, so many people were covering his songs. They've been heard every week on the BBC by the Beatles, the Yardbirds, the Stones, the Kinks.
Girls, you've got a date with the Bachelors.
Why the
Al Saxon. The Merseybeats.
Blue where are you? I've cried the long night through.
The Applejacks.
I'm crying.
It's a great lineup of stars and music. We think you should come and see it. And so does Millie. Which just leaves Freddie and the Dreamers to remind you that it's
just for you.
One thing I did want to talk about on the left-hand column, Freddie and the Dreamers single. One of those light, fluffy ditties in the You Were Made For Me mould provides the new one by Freddie and the Dreamers on Columbia. Just For You, the title song from the new movie, now on general release. And I don't know if you've seen this movie.
No.
Wowzers. It's
good wowzers or bad wowzers.
Well, it was directed by Douglas Hickox. loosely structured around a DJ called Sam Costa, who introduces performances with a fictional push-button hit parade computer. But you've got people like, it's an interesting watch, actually. It's Freddie and the Dreamers, Peter and Gordon, the Merseybeats, the Applejacks, Millie Small,
yeah,
the Bachelors, and others. But it's basically teenagers at a seaside resort and acts on a show at a pier.
I have to say I missed this one, but then there were so many copycat films being made around this time.
Of course, yeah.
But also, I mean, this is the kind of film that the Beatles were turning down, you know, this sort of idea of being part of a big sort of portmanteau film where you're one of a number of acts shoehorned in and there's some vague plot to string you all together. I mean, even in its own way, that's sort of what its trad dad, Richard Lester's previous feature film had been, but although he injected a bit more sort of comedy into it, but essentially it's just an excuse to string together a bunch of different acts.
Yes.
But they were shot really well and they were all interesting acts.
Oh, in the Potted Pops on the top right-hand column in a 0.3 font, you've got the Rattles, Tell Me What to Do. And this is the second live recording of the week, because we've also got one by Peter, Paul and Mary, Oh Rock My Soul. But this is recorded at the Star Club in Hamburg.
Oh, yes, it is,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So it's kind of like La Bamba kind of thing. But it's really nice to have a good quality live Star Club recording. And you think, with Peter Jackson messing around with the Beatles' Star Club recordings, this gives you a good indication of what that might actually sound like. It's really good quality.
Interesting.
Shine bright and shine your troubles away. Or tell me, what can I do?
Page 7, there's the singles chart. Before we look at this chart, I did want to mention two adverts on either side of the page.
Sure.
We've got one from EMI and one from Decca. And Decca had obviously made the biggest mistake in music history by not taking the Beatles. It's interesting to see how Decca's desperation to make up for this. And they've basically signed all and sundry to try and find another Beatles, including fellow Cavern band King Size Taylor and the Dominoes and the Rattles. So I don't know if they sent an A&R person to the Star Club. And parallel to the Decca's release, it's got EMI. It's a lot classier. You've got Ray Charles, Long John Baldry, yeah, and also Stan Getz, Astrid Gilberto.
Yeah, the girl from Ipanema, the vocal by Astrid Gilberto. I mean, just, yeah, completely different level. And then at the bottom, you've got the Capitol Records, number one in the States, the Beach Boys, I Get Around, and you know, you can see the seeds of the great rivalry to come.
Yeah. I mean, what a chart.
Well, you know, Has the Rising Sun at number one is just amazing. I'm struck by those, you know, things like, again, musical songs like Hello Dolly by Louis Armstrong, yes, from the, you know, the film, and then Kissing Cousins by Elvis Presley is quite high. And I was looking, where do the Beatles appear? And actually, they're at number 11, aren't they, with the Long Tall Sally EP. And Cliff Richard's On the Beach, which is probably the best song from Wonderful Life, is
well, it's a Noi Paramore one, yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing just mix. I mean, you have that sense of all these different forces colliding, like they're all thrown into a big bathtub together and they're sloshing around. Chapel of Love, which is such a great track, Dixie Cups, you've got some of those great African-American girl bands in there.
And the new entries, like New Entry, Tobacco Road, no one had ever heard, you know, it's...
And then you've got things like John Lee Hooker's Dimples, which I think the Animals covered.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you have some of those real originals in there, not just the kind of cover versions.
Yeah, got a couple of versions of Hello Dolly, Frankie Vaughan's in there as well.
Yeah. And then if you look at the best-selling pop singles in the US, it's amazing how many UK acts are in there.
Yes.
Peter and Gordon and Billy J. Kramer along. I don't know, it's just a remarkable time. Yeah, just a remarkable time.
Yeah, and then page 8 and 9, we have news. And it, as you're saying, on left-hand column, it says, Beatles, Dusty leap into US top 10. Both the Beatles and Dusty Springfield into the US top 10, published by Cashbox next week. The Beatles, A Hard Day's Night leaps from 56 to 9, as its second week in the top 100. Dusty's Wishing and Hoping rises 8 places to 10. And you also got I Should Have Known Better at 89, Ain't She Sweet at 81, Dave Clark 5, The Searchers, Peter and Gordon, Cilla Black, The Bachelors, who are Irish, Rolling Stones,
Yeah, the Bachelors, you know, the Bachelors crop up quite a lot around this time. And if you ever listen to the old Sounds of the 60s, when it was presented by, was it Brian Matthews used to present Sounds of the 60s? Yeah, they used to play a lot of the Bachelors and these Irish acts. But, you know, we've filtered them out of our cultural memory, haven't we?
Yeah.
But they were quite big at the time. They were huge. But the big headline, of course, is Beatles Night, as in short for Hard Day's Night. LP sales head for world record. And this is the amazing story that they'd already sold a million records of that album in the US, which was the whole reason that United Artists wanted to make a film anyway, was because the music division wanted an album. They thought they could cash in on this band that was set, that would going to sell them records. And they delivered. The film was in profit before, you know, it even opened because of the album sales.
Oh, big time. Yeah. On the bottom left, pop liners. This is info about Jukebox Jewelry, etc., and its TV shows. Dora Bryan and Ian Hendry joined Nancy Roberts on Jukebox Jury on July the 18th.
Well, it's like that, you know, it's where you'd find out where you could see the stars you might be interested in. But it seems a bit too random. I mean, I'm not sure why Dora Bryan and Ian Hendry would be considered key. I suppose it's just to know who's on Jukebox Jury. So sometimes they would have, you know, actors, and they weren't necessarily, you know, the big name pop stars.
But at this time, I think light entertainment and pop were very close. There wasn't that much different, you know, they'd all be hanging around together at the
Dora Bryan's a different generation, though, to be fair.
Yeah, but Roy Castle, the swinging blue jeans, tremolos, they're all kind of listed together with no, there seems to be no differentiation between these people. They're just sort
I
of
suppose
like,
there's a certain thrill that they're all, that all these people are on television and where to catch them. And again, it's, you know, this is the era before commercial, before pop radio that's easily available. If you want to see your stars other than buying their records and hear them, you might catch them on a TV show. Those are the only places to catch them, or listening to Radio Luxembourg. There's no other opportunity to sort of see them unless you go to a gig. And I think that's one of the biggest differences that we just don't appreciate, is how, you know, the 60s music wasn't a constant soundtrack as you wandered around the streets of your of the UK. It was something you had to play in private, or you had to go to a club to hear, or you had to go to a gig to hear it. You certainly didn't have it coming out the radio at you.
No. And also the fact that so much stuff around this time's wiped. This is the only this is the only information we now have of who was on what at this time. I think it was you who made a brilliant observation about how stuff was wiped that was deemed not that important. And they kept things like operas and, you know,
interviews with sort of politicians and things. It was actually someone, I think it might have been Chris Perry, who is a big sort of TV treasure hunter in a way. You know, he finds missing things and puts them together and is very involved in Missing, Believed, Wiped. And he was the one who said, you know, it's the ephemera that actually we treasure now. You know, the continuity announcements, the pop music acts. I mean, you know, an episode of Top of the Pops tells us more about what was going on in youth culture than, you know, a news report, which is filtered through the perspective of, you know, the older, socially sort of middle class, and so, and people who saw themselves as superior, looking down on you know, ordinary people as they saw it, and like, what are ordinary people into? It wasn't, you know, it wasn't being done as equals. Whereas at the Top of the Pops, you're seeing the acts, no one's mediating them. You know, you're just seeing them coming straight through to the to you through the camera lens. It's what's thrilling about it.
One hit says, two Ready Steady shows in one night. Due to the ITV strike, cancelling Rediffusion's Ready Steady Go last Friday, tonight's edition will be a special all-star show combining some of the artists previously scheduled for last week with those already set for today. This was the first major industrial dispute to affect ITV. Technicians walked out on the 1st of July demanding pay rise, a 35-hour week and better overtime rates, arguing staff should share in the network's growing profits because ITV was making absolute millions at this time. And most regions broadcast only test cards, and it was only a 5-day stoppage. But that would have been a big, big thing at the time, with only three channels.
Well, and of course, there was a lot more industrial action to come through the 70s, as you know. I love the idea that there were so many big pop acts around Britain at the time that they're all backing up, like, you know, tankers to go through the Suez Canal. And, you know, you've got to find space to accommodate them. What a nightmare. Or, you know, like when the escalator stopped working on the tube station and you're all backed up trying to get on the platform. There's something quite touching about them having to reconfigure the shows to accommodate these huge names and shuffle some of the lesser ones onto the next show.
And what a combination. You've got the Swinging Blue Jeans, Baron Knights, Manfred Mann, The Searchers, Dusty Springfield, and the Pete Best Four.
Oh.
Bless him.
Bless him.
I'm a bright as a jumping bean, riding high if you see what I mean, 'cause I've got a horse, I've got a horse.
Page 9, we have Billy Fury. There's more music here.
Yeah, so everyone is clearly trying to put acts into film musicals, with the Beatles doing it too. So the headline is Billy Fury, star of film musical. I have never heard of this from when it was made. Billy Fury will star with his horse in a spectacular colour screen musical to be made this autumn. That just sounds very strange to me.
Is
this horse very important in his career?
No. I've never seen it, and I desperately want to see it. It's
called I've Got a Horse.
Yeah.
Does it exist? Did this film get made?
Yes. It's a musical comedy, and it's directed by Kenneth Hume, starred Billy Fury, Amanda Barry.
Oh, I love Amanda Barry.
I love Amanda Barry. And John Pertwee. Interested?
Well, I'm more interested in it's partly penned by David Henniker, who part wrote Half a Sixpence, the musical, which is a good musical.
And as well as Billy, there was music from The Bachelors.
Oh, yeah, surprise, and there's a shot. Surprise. There's a shot of them shooting in Blackpool. Yeah, this is just odd. This is just odd. I'm really glad that we don't remember this film. Maybe it's been wiped with any luck.
It hasn't. I've got to see it. How's this for a plot, right? Based on the star's famous love of animals, the musical comedy portrays Billy setting out to add a sheepdog to his vast entourage of animals and coming back with an irresistible horse named Armitage instead. To his manager's horror, Billy smuggles the horse backstage during rehearsals for his big show, and the horse proceeds to create havoc. Little do either of them know that Armitage is actually a thoroughbred racehorse. Then Billy's horse contracts pneumonia.
They tell you the whole plot of the film. This is the IMDb listing or something, is it? Wikipedia?
No, this is just bits all over the web.
Oh, okay.
People who've seen it, and this is basically the plot. Yeah, gets pneumonia. And Billy must choose between the love of his horse and the big show.
Right.
So no spoilers.
So just to contrast that, with on the right, there's an advert for the latest single from EMI on the right of the same page. And it includes the Beatles single of A Hard Day's Night with the B-side, Things We Said Today. And you just think, Things We Said Today is like a play for today. You know, it's got so much emotional strangeness going on in it. It's quite sophisticated. They're like light years ahead of some of the dross,
yes,
being produced in their wake. I mean, in a way, it's a relief to know that, you know, one's instincts are right. There's a reason why the Beatles are revered and a lot of these other acts have disappeared without trace because, well, I mean, Billy Fury obviously did some great stuff, but obviously that film was not one of his highlights.
As Beatles fans, I think we think of each year, you think 64, what they were releasing, singles and the albums, and you kind of think that is the benchmark of what music was doing at that time. But going through these magazines, they're like 2-3 years ahead of everyone. There's no one doing what they're doing. And it really brings it home to you. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And like you say, they haven't let us down.
Yeah.
Somebody always talking about the way she walks. Somebody's always talking about the way she talks. Somebody always thinking of something smart to say. Somebody always trying to take my baby away. Somebody always telling her she looks so fine. Somebody always trying to make her change her mind. Somebody always trying to lead her, astray. Somebody always trying to take my baby away.
Page 10. Got more singles reviewed by Derek Johnson, including King Size Taylor, an old Beatles star.
Small things I wanted to point out, which is actually at the bottom of page 8, there was a little mention of Johnny Dankworth becoming the first non-classical music act to play the Bexhill Music Festival. And I thought that was a useful reminder of just how long it was taking some of the kind of impact of Beatles and jazz and modern music to filter through to all the corners of the UK. And the other thing I noticed on page 9 was that Philip Jones was appointed the new head of light, well, in fact, it was a new created role of light entertainment at ATV. And he had previously been at Thank Your Lucky Stars, which, of course, was a programme that really put the Beatles on the map for many adults, where they first encountered them, I think, in 63 in particular. And he'd also televised the NME Poll Winners' Party, which was quite a big event at Wembley Pool. So I think you're starting to see television organisations try and make moves to make programming that perhaps is more attuned to picking up on what's going on in society at large. I mean, I know that, what's that show that Cathy McGann presented, we were talking, Oh Boys. No, that's not Oh Boys.
Ready, Steady, Go.
Sorry. So we know Ready, Steady, Go has been underway for a bit and it struggles a bit with audiences, but there's still a lot more to be done, isn't there? And it feels like they're still just getting into gear, the big TV broadcasters, to think about all these young people could be watching television and we could be selling products to them.
Yeah, of course. Yes, there's more singles. There's so many singles they've had to do in two separate things. One thing I did want to mention, the Paramounts, I'm the One Who Loves You, which is the Curtis Mayfield cover.
Yeah.
And this and their subsequent singles didn't really chart, but it's really good. It's well worth listening to. But the Paramounts became Procol Harum.
Oh.
It's really weird hearing this song because Gary Brooker, you think of White Shade of Pale and Homburg and all of those. But it's weird hearing in this context. It's a bit like a Zombies song, but sung by Gary Brooker. Oh, check it out then.
I will definitely check it out.
Best friend to tell another guy started again. Yes, once more you look in my eyes, and one more time you want to realize that I'm the one who loved you. I'm the one who loved you. Love me.
You see, you can. I'm discovering new music through this issue of NME from July 1964. Once you filter out the dross, there's some real gems waiting to be discovered, even by me. Well, the thing I want to buy after reading this issue is the Sounds Incorporated cover of Spanish Harlem. I mean, Spanish Harlem is such a great song, and I love all the different covers. But I haven't heard the Sounds Incorporated version. Of course, they performed with the Beatles at Shea Stadium, didn't they?
Yes, yeah. And on Good Morning, Good Morning, they're doing the saxophones on that. And Sandy Shaw, this is her debut single.
Really?
As Long As You're Happy. Yeah, yeah. Because she left school, Sandra Ann Goodrich, but she worked at the Ford Dagenham factory.
That's right.
Did some part-time modelling. Came second prize in a talent competition, which got her a prize for performing at a charity concert where she was spotted by Adam Faith, who's mentioned in this.
That's right, yeah.
And teamed up with Chris Andrews and wrote this. Sadly, it didn't make the charts. But obviously from then on, there's always something there to remind me. And she got the number one by autumn.
Yeah, she's got great presence, great delivery. Yeah. I mean, like the opposite to someone like Cilla, I have to say. Sandy Shaw just effortlessly delivers cool in her voice, doesn't she? She's got a strong voice, but she doesn't feel the need to hit us over the head with it.
Poor old Cilla. Anyway. And again, we're talking about singles. We've got, you know, two separate pages. And there's literally just a quarter page about new albums, notably off the Beatle track, George Martin's. It's weird to think that was released on the same day as A Hard Day's Night. It's his orchestral covers of Beatles songs.
Yeah, I mean, I love George Martin. He was an important figure, but they've put out some odd stuff. Maybe there was a different audience in there, and there were all these people who would buy an instrumental, very easy listening version of things. I mean, his orchestration for the film of A Hard Day's Night got an Oscar nomination, which I think Richard Lester felt a bit miffed by. I don't know, which is, you know, a lot of the power of the film was obviously the way that he filmed the songs, the original songs of the Beatles, rather than the arrangements of, you know, the jazzy music when Granddad is trying to run in and out of the theatre and stuff. Yeah. But anyway, he didn't win an Oscar.
But you look at the albums, and they're just such an afterthought at this time. You've got Judy Garland, Pat Boone, and then there's a section on the right-hand column, piano albums. They're breaking them down into piano, and then further down, comedy albums. Bob Newhart.
That would have been a big thing. Bob Newhart would have been a big thing. Mm. And I mean, there's a Peter Sellers story somewhere here, isn't he? He's recovering from a heart attack and is
going
to be performing at the Night of the 100 Stars or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the great sort of collaborations of the Beatles is with the world of comedy, isn't it? Whether it's having a comedy producer in George Martin or actually the people they admired and they hung out with.
Oh, totally, yeah.
New from Brolac, spotless emulsion paint. It doesn't drip, it doesn't run. Even when painting ceilings, Brolac Spotless PEP is the liquid plastic emulsion paint. The liquid paint that doesn't drip makes painting a cleaner, easier job. Gay and bright in spotless white and six new spotless colours. Get Brolac Spotless PEP. It's drip-free.
And this, right, I spent, I'm not joking, 2 days on this advert at the bottom. It's an advert for Fabulous magazine. Enter the great Fabulous Oxfam Beat contest today.
For fans.
Yeah, right. So this was organised by Oxfam Secretary Lydia Cornell, who had to sort out all of the coupons from Fab magazine into 11 regions where Beat Time for Oxfam were due to take place over the coming weeks, and then get them all sent off to the regional teams. And she said at the time she'd never had to work so hard in her whole life. And the winner of one of the regional heats in Leith was a band called Mark Five, which featured Manny Charlton, who later went on to achieve success as founding member of Nazareth.
Okay, it's not bad.
But yeah, this is really weird, right? The grand final took place on the 27th of September 1964 at the Prince of Wales Theatre in London.
Yeah.
And the judging panel included Betty Hole from Fabulous magazine, Ringo Starr, Brian Epstein, your favourite Cilla Black, and Billy Hatton, who was the bassist with the Foremost. And the second half of the show was actually broadcast live on BBC Two during a programme called It's Beat Time. And we've got a list of the finalists, which include the Southerners, the Connoisseurs, the Starfires, the Apaches, who had actually previously played support for the Beatles in 63.
Yeah.
And there is no record anywhere of who won. There's rumours that either the Connoisseurs or Danny Clark and the Jaguars came second, but there's nothing anywhere of who won. So if there's anybody out there listening, and I find it incredible, you think all of the documentation we've got and there's just no record of it.
Well, I'm trying to work that word into it as well. It's strange.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is really odd. Well, I quite like the, what do you call it when you throw shade on things? So there's an advert for the Top Rank Majestic Ballroom. The group that ungassed the Stones, the Pretty Things. And then it also has Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated band. I mean, there are some real interesting kind of grown-up R&B bands in here.
Oh, if you know
where to look.
Because Dick Taylor had been in the original Stones, hadn't he, before joining this band.
That's quite funny.
I saw a girl in my dream. So it seems that I will love her. Oh, you are that girl in my dreams. And so it seems that I will love you. And I waiting for your kiss, waiting for the bliss like dreamers do.
There's a big article, an interview with the Applejacks, another Decca band known for the Brumbeat sound, but famous for, well, unusual at the time, for having a female bass player, Megan Davis.
Yeah, what did Megan go on to do?
Well, basically, it's just a typical band. Decca really screwed them around, because obviously they did a version of the Beatles like Dreamers do.
Yeah.
But Decca were forcing them to do a cover of Mary Poppins' song Chim Chimmery, which they absolutely hated and flat out refused to record it. It's basically all about publishing rights and mechanical royalties, because if a band writes their own hit song, bands get the fair share.
David Bowie didn't mind doing a cover of that, didn't he? And one of his early bands do a cover of Chim Chimmery.
Yeah, yeah, but I don't know. They wanted to be taken seriously. I mean, he could get away with throwing it away. Basically, because the band refused to record it, Decca stalled their career and held back the release of their next single for 6 months, which in the 60s obviously was a huge time. And by the late 60s, it completely screwed them. They were playing on cruise ships And yeah, Megan eventually ended up quitting music industry and became a nurse for the NHS. Mm. One of the so many bands at the time, company, you know, record companies and management just taking the piss, really.
Yeah.
Although we do have Nat Hentoff's American Airmail. We've got news from America.
Some of it just sounds a bit random, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Although you get, so John Lennon's in his own right, he's number six in the, presumably the New York Times non-fiction chart.
Yeah, the Beatles' contract for their two Las Vegas shows, according to columnist Sidney Skosky, calls for at least 100 policemen for protection.
I mean, it's all, you know, I suppose what really strikes you is the way this thing's put together is it feels like it's a load of random facts thrown together and filling pages bit by bit. It's a real jigsaw puzzle, and you'd have to go through it line by line to spot references to the Beatles, for example. If you were thinking, what's the news about the Beatles? There's bits of information scattered throughout this
newspaper
on different pages. They haven't actually got a section. You'd think you'd have, like, your Beatles roundup page. It's much more random than that.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose it partly depends. If it was, this is a weekly newspaper, and it's all being, I don't know, it's being manually typeset as well. You're filling pages kind of as you can. And then the number of adverts that are coming in as well with the singles.
On the bottom of that page, talking of which, that Mary Wells and Marvin Gaye advert, Once Upon a Time single. It's interesting that the picture that they've got there, which is beautiful, they look so beautiful in it, they've actually flipped it, because on the US single it was the other way around, so Marvin Gaye had first billing. But of course at this time Mary Wells was currently in the charts with My Guy, and Marvin Gaye wouldn't really have a hit over here until November.
Oh, very savvy.
With How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You.
Yeah. So.
Just a random thing. Anyway, you carry on.
No, well, then you go to the next page and there's more. Well, I start to get really drawn into the adverts which appear. So, you know, you think about 60s clothes and Cuban heels and things. And actually the adverts are for things like, you too can have a body like mine, the same inadequacy as ever. And then the safari flip-on jerkin in ocelot pile fab fabric, only 39 and 6. What is a flip-on jerkin, Chris? Was this a big thing in the 60s that I missed?
Well, according to this, it's a purry, furry pullover, feline.
It's basically a sleeveless sort of leopard print pullover.
Kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very odd. And then is that Charles Atlas on the right?
Oh, yeah. Who else?
Oh, bless Charles Atlas. He did have a body like mine. And then great news mods. Only by taking over the complete production of a well-known felt badge manufacturer can we make such an offer. So they're offering, what, sort of special letters to sew on your jumper?
Yes.
Very strange. Oh, and then bless, this is all the male inadequacy comes out here, right near the bottom. Okay. Why be bald? DeMarco hair pieces acclaimed by stars of stage and screen as the best are now available to you. Oh, that's so sweet. 31 George Street in London, you could go and get your hairdressing salon for hairpiece wearers with while you wait hairpiece cleaning and grooming facilities. That's so sweet. I'm kind of glad that in a way people have got beyond that. And now everyone knows, like, come on, you know, you can't be cooler than Stanley Tucci. You just shave your head.
Yes.
Let's talk about, instead, about the big new Photoplay issue magazine with the big picture of Bond is back, Sean Connery, in brackets, wow, in Goldfinger.
Yeah.
So obviously this was the kind of, you know, big film magazine of the time, and it's making a big thing about how much... Oh, and it's got a feature from George Chakiris, who of course was in West Side Story, but it's now starring in 633 Squadron. Talks of the one thing that bugs him about women. It's funny, isn't it, this obsession with asking stars about their taste in women. It just seems odd. You wouldn't really do it anymore. You wouldn't ask someone, you know, what kind of girls do you like? But they used to ask the Beatles this all the time, didn't they? And then there's a peek behind the scenes of the Beatles film, swinging feature and big picture spread too. And so on the bottom right-hand corner, there's a big advert for the new issue of Photoplay with the top story, with a lovely picture of Sean Connery saying Bond is back. And then there's references to George Chakiris and the Beatles, Peter and Gordon, and stuff about them. That lists real-life colour portraits of Sean Connery, Freddie, Susan Hampshire, Honor Blackman, Peter Sellers, Dick Van Dyke and Paul Newman. Would you really want a big real-life colour portrait of Peter Sellers? I don't know, maybe you would. And then I love that you finally get an advert buried at the bottom of that page of the Hard Day's Night album. Out today, the Beatles' new LP. With the lovely photographs by Robert Freeman of that, like a contact sheet.
One thing I picked up on that was the fact they've only paid for a quarter page ad, because they knew full well it wouldn't need to pay for a full page ad because everyone would buy it. I love that.
Yeah. And I also love that they're on the same page and as the James Bond, Sean Connery picture. I mean, you've read that wonderful book.
John Higgs.
John Higgs's fantastic book. I really loved it about, what is it called? Love and Let Die.
Love and Let Die.
About Bond versus the Beatles. And there's a real story about that sort of, they're intertwined through the 60s, aren't they? These two very different plays on Britishness and British manhood in particular.
And if you get the audio book, you can hear me and him talking about it.
Oh, really?
Great plug. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. And then you start to get into the really tiny ads and the personals.
Yes.
2 shillings per word. And Screaming Lord Sutch.
He's everywhere.
He's everywhere. Georgie Fame in the Blue Flames.
Alma Cogan, obviously rumoured to, she and John Lennon had an affair with him, yeah.
Yeah, well. Oh, and then is this a gossip column near the end, Tail Pieces by the Alley Cat?
Oh, yes. Because like the rest of the magazine's basically just plain reporting. And this really is interesting. It's quite biting. It's foreshadowing sort of future music journalism. And it was the Alley Cat or Tail Pieces. And it's basically a long-running gossip column, but it was written under a pseudonym by the Enemy's publisher, Maurice Kinn. And it was a staple of the back page. And it is absolutely random. But it is sort of like 1970s, 80s, 90s biting journalism. It's completely at odds with the rest of the issue. But it's things like Jukebox Jury appearance by Rolling Stones, an utter disgrace. I think because he's going under a pseudonym, he's getting a bit more, you know, like going on Twitter or something under a load of numbers. Why isn't Joe Brown recording better material? Isn't Adam Faith too dependent on Chris Andrews' compositions? How about the Rolling Stones for TV's University Challenge? I don't think he likes the Stones. Who invited Brian Jones and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones to an exclusive party after the Beatles' film premiere? He doesn't like them. But it's, that is probably my favourite bit of this.
Mm. Well, I'm looking further down and they've got the full listings for Radio Luxembourg programmes. And on, I like that, you assume it's all, like, you know, there's Brian Matthews and all these kind of pop programmes. And then actually, if you look on Thursday, it says Radio Bible Class. Isn't that sweet?
Awesome. I'd listen to that.
Yeah. I wonder who's the presenter of that.
Yeah.
Postal bingo requests. How does that work?
I generally don't know. Of the whole issue, that's the one thing I wish I'd looked up.
Wonderful Egg Pot Express.
So anyway, the Enemy and Melody Maker were always rivals, but according to Enemy journalist Chris Selovich, from about 1967 onwards, Melody Maker was the more popular paper because it covered album rock. And IPC bought the title in 69, appointed Alan Smith as editor, who headhunted all the underground writers, and the rest is history. In August 2013, the magazine became a free publication and is now only an online resource, although it's particularly useful for providing hints for Wordle. That's all I use it for these days. Oh. So, Samira, first of all, why do you think people from our generation are so fascinated by the 60s, and what did this publication mean to you?
Well, I think they're fascinated with the 60s because it's like a big bang, isn't it? This other stuff might have been bubbling under before, but everything opens up and it's British focused. This energy, this music, and the sheer volume of talented stars, musical, cinematic writers, many of whom come from working class backgrounds. And I think it's something we talked about before, which is this is ultimately the 1944 Education Act coming to fruition, isn't it? It's that whole generation who grew up with a proper funded state education, civic libraries, the NHS, lack of conscription, and they all go out and achieve, or a lot of them do. And there's, you know, relatively full employment in the 60s. So I think there's partly a nostalgia for a time when young people kind of were leading the world and made the world a better place. And I mean, as for Enemy itself, I mean, it's interesting how actually quite poor quality most of the writing is at this time. It is just that it contains the names. It's like the records, the written record of what was going on at the time. And I think it's interesting that the music has survived in a way that the publications like these haven't really, not just because they're ephemeral, but because they weren't well written. You know, kind of great magazine. I mean, think about, you know, the Sherlock Holmes short stories all appeared in magazines, didn't they, in the 19th century, early 20th century.
Dickens as well.
Yeah, and they're great works of art. And actually, the great works of art survive in their own right. So you go and find the albums, you find the films, you look at the artworks of pop artists like Pauline Boty or Peter Blake. You don't actually look in the magazines because the magazines just couldn't really... they didn't really have a full inkling of just how monumental was the art that was being created at this time. And they're completely inadequate at capturing it, aren't they? Apart from that gossip column at the end, which was quite fun. You're just struck by how they don't have the language, they don't have the grasp of quite what's happening.
I think it gets better as the 60s go on. And I do love the lack of hindsight.
That is true. But there's an indiscriminate, isn't there, excitement about everything. Like every minor Merseybeat band is accorded with the same excitement as if they might be the new Beatles. Well, why not wait and see first? I mean, the Animals are the only band in this issue that I really feel justify the way they're written about. But that's because the journalist with them is just paying attention to what they're saying and what they're doing. And just capturing... That's what captures the excitement of the 60s, that interview.
Absolutely. So, thank you, Samira, and good luck with the book. I guess this will probably be out by the time your book's already out. So, congratulations on the success of your book.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I would say that I'm doing quite a lot of events at literary festivals around the UK from the end of March onwards. And I'm doing some film screenings and Q&A outside of London. So I'm definitely doing one in Newcastle on, I think it's May the 16th, which is a Saturday. So if you're in the Northeast, you come to that. And I'm trying to do one in Belfast in Northern Ireland as well in May as well. And I'm doing things like Hay on Wye and Bath and... And basically, I'm trying to do my own version of the Beatles doing crazy touring in an old van with a broken windscreen, although they won't have a broken windscreen, but I'm going crazy places. Like I'm going to Newcastle, then I'm coming down to go to Bath the next day.
Wow.
I know.
Well, driving.
Oh, I'm not going to do that by train. I have to do things by train to be in the spirit of the book. And I'm going to the Lake District and Lake District Literary Festival and Oxford and Cambridge Literary Festivals and... You know, you might just see me on a train and, you know, we could go to the...
Put the radio on and try and open the window.
Put the radio on and I will tell you to turn it off. But I hope you like the book. I hope you like the book.
It's a brilliant book, folks. Please go and get... We haven't said the title.
Oh, so it's a BFI... It's in the BFI Film Classics series, which is published by Bloomsbury Books. And it's called A Hard Day's Night. And it's basically... Each book, I mean, I've written just one, they take a classic film and they explain, they make the case for why it's an important film, and they partly analyse it as an individual watching it, but also give you a story about the making of it, why it's important and so on. So I pitched and got to do this one, which is the one that I really wanted to do. And I should say it's coming out in the UK on April the 2nd, but there's a separate US edition coming out in June, I think June the 11th. So wherever you are, you should be able to buy it. And I'm also recording an audiobook.
Are you?
Yeah, I won't be able to do it. I'm a bit worried when I have to quote the Beatles. I can't do a Scouser.
You can do the accent. Is Mick Jagger in it at all?
I might need to hire in a professional Scouser to read the voices for me.
Go on, have a bash. I reckon that would be super.
I can say grotty. That's about all I can say.
Perfect.
I'm from South London and I've never pretended to be anything else. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for everything you've done as well, because this book wouldn't have happened without you.
Oh, don't make me cry.
You get an acknowledgement in the book. Have you not seen?
Yes, I know. I can't believe it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris.
So, thanks to Susie Humphrey for the jingles and to read this issue of New Musical Express. The magazine's online at irontheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. For now, thank you, Samira Ahmed. It's been a joy.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. It's always a joy talking to you.